You are listening to KBOO Portland. From a quarantine studio brought to you by KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, Philonese Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, testified on Wednesday morning to the House Judiciary Committee on the issue of police accountability. The testimony was held a day after the high-profile victim of Minneapolis police killing was laid to rest. Here are excerpts from Philonese Floyd's opening remarks.
I couldn't take care of George that day. He was killed. But maybe by speaking with you today, I can make sure that his death would not be in vain. Enough is enough. The people marching in the streets are telling you enough is enough. By the leaders that is our country, the world needs the right thing. The people elected you to speak for them, to make positive change. George's name means something. You have the opportunity here today to make your names mean something too. If his death ends up changing the world for the better, and I think it will, then he died as he lived. It is on you to make sure his death is not in vain. I didn't get the chance to say goodbye to Perry while he was here. I was robbed of that. But I know he's looking down at us now. Perry, look up at what you did. Big brother, you changed the world. Thank you for everything. For taking care of us when on earth, for taking care of us now. I hope you found mama and you can rest in peace with power. Thank you.
That's the voice of Philonese Floyd, George Floyd's brother, speaking to the House Judiciary Committee on Wednesday. On the same day, the Minneapolis Police Department announced that it would be withdrawing from negotiations with the police union. Police Chief Maderia Arradondo gave a news conference explaining his decision.
I am immediately withdrawing from the contract negotiations with the Minneapolis Police Federation. I plan to bring in subject matter experience and advisors to conduct a thorough review of how the contract can be restructured to provide greater community transparency and more flexibility for a true reform.
That's Minneapolis Police Chief Maderia Arredondo addressing reporters on Wednesday morning about ending negotiations with the powerful police union that has contributed significantly to police impunity. Presidential candidate Joe Biden addressed Floyd's funeral on Tuesday in a 5-minute videotaped speech, complete with moving soundtrack.
We can't turn away. We must not turn away. We cannot leave this moment thinking we can once again turn away from racism that stings at our very soul, from systemic abuse that still plagues American life.
That's an excerpt of Joe Biden giving a funeral videotaped speech at George Floyd's funeral on Tuesday. Biden, who as senator invited a police union to help him write a bill on criminal justice, has moved to the left on the issue of police accountability, but still maintains an opposition to the new rallying cry of defund the police. Meanwhile, the Republican Party has been caught off guard with a rapidly evolving position of the American public on police violence, as President Donald Trump has focused on spreading lies and conspiracy theories about the victims of police brutality and those protesting it, and cast himself as the law and order president, some GOP lawmakers are scrambling to distance themselves from this tone-deaf rhetoric. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has asked Senator Tim Scott, the only Black Republican senator, to lead the party's response to the current political landscape. However, Senator Tom Cotton, who has openly called for the deployment of the U.S. military to squash American protests, has introduced a bill opposing the defunding of police departments. In a sign of the times that we live in, the long-running pro-police reality TV show called Cops has been cancelled. Launched in 1989, Cops, for more than three decades, reinforced the notions that police always act in the best interest of the public and that Black and brown victims were deserving of arrests. On the date that the show was scheduled to premiere its 33rd season, the Paramount Network, which had taken over the show from Fox, announced it would not air. Activists around the world are targeting statues that glorify historic racism. Here in the United States, activists destroyed two statues of Christopher Columbus in Massachusetts and in Virginia. The Virginia statue was toppled and dumped into a lake. In Britain, where a statue of a slave trader was toppled and thrown into a river, there is now a fierce debate over a Winston Churchill statue. And in Belgium, Black Lives Matter activists want to bring down a statue of King Leopold over his racist and colonialist legacy. While primary elections were held in four states in the U.S. on Tuesday, it was the state of Georgia that made the most headlines. Across Georgia, a state known for its disenfranchisement of people of color, officials struggled with a new $100 million voting machine system that resulted in many hours of wait times, particularly in communities of color. The day ended with an extended window to vote and a promise of investigations rather than an announcement of winners. In news related to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, troubling signs of a resurgence of infections are on the American horizon. Although infection rates in 24 states are trending downward, in 7 states they're holding steady, and in 19 others there is a troubling rise in COVID-19 cases. Chief among those is Arizona, where health experts are warning that hospitals may be reaching their bed capacity quite soon. The nation's chief infectious diseases expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, is warning that the pandemic is, quote, far from over, and that the virus is his, quote, worst nightmare. More than 110,000 people have died in the U.S. alone, and globally that figure is 400,000. Fauci added, where is it going to end? We're still at the beginning of it. A new study published in Britain concluded that a second wave of infections globally could be staved off if enough of a nation's population wore face masks, even homemade cloth masks. The study's lead author said our analyses support the immediate and universal adoption of face masks by the public. While the U.S. has been the leader in coronavirus infections and deaths for some months, Latin America's most populous country could overtake it. There has been a deeply troubling rise of COVID-19 infections in Brazil, where the spread of the disease has been described as a free fall. In Brazil's favelas, home to many of the nation's poorest, residents have taken to organizing their own response to the virus in the absence of leadership from Brazil's authoritarian president, Jair Bolsonaro. According to the Washington Post, in Sao Paulo, people who live in poorer areas and contract the virus are up to 10 times more likely to die than people in wealthy areas, according to the data released by the city's health department. Black Sao Paulo residents are 62% more likely to die from the virus than white residents. The Bolsonaro government recently came under fire for manipulating COVID-19 data and was forced by the nation's Supreme Court to restore a national tracking database. Most troublingly, there are now reports that Bolsonaro's government is exploring the use of the military in order to hold on to power. Bolsonaro's own son, who is an admirer of Brazil's former military dictatorship, said, quote, "It's no longer an opinion about if, but when this will happen." And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The demand for cities to defund their police stations is not a new one. It is only new to those who are finally taking seriously a core demand of the Black Lives Matter movement. While many are asking and debating what it means to defund the police, one need look no further than the work that activists have been doing for years. In Los Angeles, California, where the Liberal Democratic Mayor Eric Garcetti finally capitulated to a modest decrease in the LAPD's outsized budget, Black Lives Matter's LA chapter has laid extensive groundwork for a campaign that they call a People's Budget LA. A day after the historic budget cut, Dr. Melina Abdullah, a prominent member of Black Lives Matter LA, spoke to The Intercept about it.
Yesterday, the people won an initial victory against a police state that our mayor, Eric Garcetti, sought to usher in with his terrible budget proposal that sought to give LAPD 54% of the city's general fund. He tried to fast track it through city council, but the people stood up and said no. We were successful in stopping that move and getting that budget proposal back to the budget committee where we can have a voice. What's next is the people saying, what do we want? What do we want to prioritize? We want to prioritize a budget that centers care, not cops. We need you to make your voice heard by looking for our survey that says, what do you want to spend on? Do we want to spend on housing and healthcare and educational enrichment? Do we want to spend on mental health resources and things that actually make communities safe, not brutalize, harass, and terrorize communities the way LAPD does?
That's Melina Abdullah, professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University of Los Angeles, speaking to a reporter about a modest cut to Los Angeles's police budget. Dr. Abdullah now joins me. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So this issue of defunding the police, to many people who haven't been paying attention, sounds like a new idea. Of course, it's not a new idea, especially for folks like yourself who have been talking about this as part of the Black Lives Matter movement. There's such a debate about it. The Washington Post editorial board, you know, has an extensive piece. New York Times has been publishing stories about it. A lot of conservative politicians are distancing themselves from it and claiming that it's equivalent to saying disband the police. But of course, Minneapolis City Council has actually talked about disbanding the police. What does defunding the police mean for you? How do you explain it to a layperson who's new to the movement?
Sure, defunding the police means exactly what it says, right? So in most major cities, police departments eat up about 50% of the general fund, meaning the tax base, right? The unrestricted funds. And we think that's way too much. Most of the time when residents see how much goes directly to police, they're outraged and shocked. And so we think that it should be cut. And we actually have engaged in a participatory budgeting session. We've sent out surveys. And most people feel that traditional approaches to law enforcement should actually receive about 5%. That includes the police department, but it also includes prosecutor's office. It also includes things like traffic enforcement. So defunding the police is about remembering that what actually makes communities safe are resources and services. And so when budgeting is absolutely a zero-sum game. When you spend 50% of your city's general fund on police, and here in Los Angeles, it's even more. Mayor Garcetti proposes spending 54% of the city's general fund on police. When you spend that much on police, it means that you don't have money for the other things that you need. So things like after school programs, permanent housing. It's no coincidence that we're spending 54% of the city's general fund on police, and we're the houseless capital of the nation, right? So 60,000 homeless people in LA County, because the city is not keeping those resources to provide permanent housing for its folks. We don't have access to healthy food. We don't have access to quality after school programs. There are very few parks around. Because they're dedicating too much money to police. So defunding the police really means recognizing that public safety should be reimagined, and we should include the essential services and resources that are necessary as the first step to creating safe communities.
So while many politicians and the public have decried the defunding of healthcare, of education, of course, we don't talk about it in that sense, but that's exactly what's happened, right? Like welfare resources, social services have been defunded. While many politicians and members of the public have initially denounced that, wished there was more, they haven't directly linked it to police budgets. It's a closed system. There's one pot of money. So if you're pouring money into one aspect of the budget, you have to take it away from another aspect. Are you heartened that this discussion around police budgets within just a few weeks has become such a mainstream talking point?
Absolutely. That defund the police has been the trending hashtag. Defund police is the trending hashtag, right? That every protest that we go to now, people have signs that say defund police. And we were talking about this, you know, for the last 5 or 6 years, but people are catching on. Absolutely speaks to the importance of this moment. I think that people are seeing George Floyd and his murder as a last straw, that they're beginning to awaken and recognize that chasing after a bad system of policing is really a waste of time, that we can no longer afford to tinker around the edges, that we have to say that, you know, this is time for transformation. We have to say it's time to defund the police so that we can fund the things that make communities safe.
And so for those people who are looking for resources, there is a very beautifully set up website, peoplesbudgetla.com, which really speaks to how much groundwork had been laid around this issue for quite a few years. There's a toolkit. You mentioned there's a survey as well, which people can look up on the website. But tell me about that survey, because that's what's been so remarkable about the work that Black Lives Matter LA has done. It hasn't just been a small huddle of activists. You've actually talked, you're part of the community, and you've surveyed the community.
Absolutely. So as we were looking at this year's budget, which is particularly outrageous, because of course it came before the murder of George Floyd, which really helped to amplify the demands. But this year's budget was a slap in the face first to Black people, because we had, before the budget came out, saw what was happening around the COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 had on Black folks. And we set up a list of demands that we sent over to the mayor's office. And this wasn't just from Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter convened a group of virtually every Black leader in LA County and said, what is it that we need? Because we wanted to make sure that resources to deal with the pandemic didn't bypass those who were most impacted by it. And so we developed a set of 55 demands, which included immediate demands like access to testing, but also no forced testing or vaccinations, right? Recognizing the history of medical racism in Black communities. It really was rooted in this idea that the underlying conditions that were being talked about in the media all traced back to anti-Black racism. And so we had the set of immediate demands, but also the set of long-term demands that got to things like, you know, we were observing an increase of police in our community during the pandemic, which made absolutely no sense because crime had virtually, had plummeted, right? So there was a 30 to 40% reduction in crime during the safer at home ordinances that we're now coming out of, right? And so it didn't make sense that they were putting more police on the streets when, you know, as we observed what police were doing, police were being stationed outside of food distribution centers where there's virtually no crime, but they were being used to intimidate people. I personally observed police cars in our grocery store parking lots who were using their power to harass Black men who were going into the stores with their face coverings on, right? And so it just didn't make sense. Why would you do that when you could hire community workers to stand outside grocery stores and food distribution centers and hand out masks or hand out gloves or provide educational materials, right? It just made no sense. So we said in that set of Black LA demands, there was an implication around divesting from police and investing in the vital services that Black people especially needed. When the mayor's budget came out, again, it was another slap in the face. It was an increase to the LAPD budget over, you know, what was already allocated, right? At a time, again, where there's a health pandemic with an economic fallout.
And this is a liberal Democrat.
This is someone who identifies as a liberal Democrat, right? But in many ways echoes people like Donald Trump, right? So as Donald Trump is calling in military on protesters, Eric Garcetti is calling in the National Guard on protesters in Los Angeles. He's having a shot with rubber bullets and beaten by batons. He's rounding people up and enacting curfews as early as 5 p.m. and issuing them at 4 p.m. So really setting up thousands upon thousands of people for arrest for nothing more than so-called curfew violations. So yes, he purports to be progressive. But his actions, you know, James Baldwin says, I don't believe what you say because I see what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, we see what Garcetti does. So he proposed this increase to LAPD while slashing virtually every other department, while furloughing 16,000 workers, mostly Black and brown. And we just thought it was an outrage. And so Black Lives Matter, as you know, is not a traditional nonprofit organization. We are just regular people who don't take a check for doing this work. This is what we believe is our sacred duty. But that also—
You're not getting paychecks from George Soros?
No. No paychecks from anybody. And so, you know, we believe that this is our duty. I'm a mom of three kids. You know that, Sonali.
Yeah.
This work is really about securing a future as a Black mom of Black, of three Black children, making sure that they're safer safer in the future than they are now. And so that's what this work is really about. And so it's beautiful, but it also means that we have very limited infrastructure. And so we began tweeting about the injustice of the mayor's budget proposal. And as we did that, those tweets were amplified by other grassroots organizations, but also other organizations that did have more infrastructure. And so an organization called the Justice Collaborative called me on a Sunday and said, hey, do you want help with this? And we were like, absolutely. And she said, well, what would you like to see? And we said, a website. And so they were able to use some of their paid staff to develop the website that we helped to co-create, you know. And we pulled together those folks that were amplifying our tweets. And we've had daily calls for the last, I guess it's been almost a month now, getting things going. And it came together really quickly. And we never miss checking in with each other. It's a daily thing, but really moving things forward. Yet on Monday, as we were engaging LA City Council Budget Committee, we were hashtagging, of course, People's Budget LA. It trended number one in the entire United States for a period of 3 hours. Wow. So this is the degree to which people are hopping on board with this call.
And so there was eventually a cut to the tune of, I believe, 100 million to 150 million. Although that sounds like a huge amount, it's still a small percentage of the LAPD budget, right? Do you call it sort of a first step in the right direction?
It's absolutely a step. And it's a step that didn't come from the awakening of Eric Garcetti. It came from a political calculation, right? So he announced this cut, $150 million cut to the LAPD budget the day after we had 5,000 people at his front door demanding that he defund the police. The same day that we had tens of thousands of folks outside of City Hall chanting defund the police. And we were told by people inside City Hall that they could absolutely hear our chants. And so it's important to remember that that step came from the organizing and the protest of the people. Also though, you know, the $150 million is almost the identical amount to what he proposed to increase the LAPD budget by. So I liken it to, you know, sometimes you go into stores that you know, really jack up their prices and then they pretend like something's on sale. That's basically what happened. He jacked up the LAPD budget and is reducing it by the amount of the increase. And so it's really important that we recognize that this is far too little too late. This was his budget in the first place. If he felt that it was important to allocate those dollars to the services and resources that communities need, he would have done that to his own budget in the first place. So we're looking for something much more significant than that, and we're going to keep fighting until we get it.
So, Melina, the issue is a national one, not just in LA, although LA has, because of Black Lives Matter's work, been a leader on this. This is, do you see this sort of model being applied to other parts of the country, and how does it contrast with the idea of actually disbanding the police system as a veto-proof majority of the Minneapolis City Council has pledged to do? There's few examples of it having been done. Camden, New Jersey is one example that's being touted that a few years ago disbanded its police department and started from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, we're really encouraged by what's happening nationally, encouraged by the announcement of Minneapolis that they're going to be disbanding their police, the divestment from police that's taking place. Minneapolis is becoming this beacon, right? That Minneapolis School District has severed ties with police. The University of Minneapolis, Minnesota system is removing police from their campuses. But it's also, we got to also remember that what's happening in Los Angeles also is informed by things that were happening throughout the country before, right? So I'm encouraged by the example of Newark, New Jersey, where Mayor Raz Baraka has begun defunding his police department, taking dollars out of the police and putting them into teams of community care workers who live in communities, who are unarmed but have the respect and ear of the communities, because they're their communities and they're not there to bully or harass or criminalize community members with guns and badges. They're there to have conversations, anticipate community needs, and engage in real work. And actually, some of that work is spearheaded by an Angeleno, by my dear brother, Akilah Shirills, has conceptualized this approach and works with Raz Baraka very closely. And so there's things moving in other parts of the country. I know that Mayor Chokwe Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi is moving in this direction as well. And so, yes, it's a national move, and I think the pace of the change has been sped up through folks recognizing what it means to be killed by police with the illustration of our brother George Floyd. And so we absolutely, he must have been a tremendous person, because his spirit is all up in this movement and has moved us so forward with such vigor. And I think that that's really, really important. I know that there's also some things moving in Los Angeles that we haven't talked about. There's calls from organizations like Students Deserve and the Black Lives Matter Youth Vanguard to remove police from LAUSD schools, and that builds on their previous work to end random searches and their current campaign to end pepper spray. And all throughout the country, up in the Bay Area, they're talking about the same thing. You see people like Chesa Boudin up in San Francisco working on decarceration, which goes hand in hand with the defunding of police. And so this is a moment. This is a transformational moment in U.S. history and in global history, really.
Melina, for several years now, Black Lives Matter LA has also been demanding that Jackie Lacey, the district attorney in LA, step down. You've had a long-standing campaign. We've had you on our program to talk about it, and weekly protests every Wednesday. I understand that last week's protest got a massive shot in the arm in terms of attendance to something that you and others have been doing for a very, very long time.
Yes, every Wednesday we are in front of Jackie Lacey's office, and we've been in front of her office for more than 2.5 years demanding that she step down. In Los Angeles, 601 people have been killed by police since she took office, and she refuses to prosecute those officers. She's running for re-election in November. And so it's important that we say this is an opportunity to get her out. As we talk about two things, two national demands are defunding the police and holding police accountable by prosecuting killer cops. When DAs refuse to do this, we have to remove those DAs. So we ask everybody to join us every Wednesday at 4 o'clock downtown at 211 West Temple and demand that Jackie Lacey must go. We're also finding there's a recent LA Times article that shows what we've been saying, that police associations who disguise themselves as unions are the main backers of this district attorney. So both the LAPD union, which is the Police Protective League, and the LA County Sheriff's Association have backed Jackie Lacey to the tune of millions of dollars. We don't have millions of dollars to counter that, but we do have masses of people. And so we wanna make sure everybody knows that, you know, all skin folk ain't kin folk. So just because Jackie Lacey happens to be Black does not make her on the side of Black people. And so we have to drive her out of office on November 3rd. And if she wants to leave earlier, we welcome that too.
And so that's every Wednesday. And I should say Los Angeles has been quite a prominent part of this nationwide movement. This past weekend, there were first estimates that 5,000 people showed up in Hollywood. That then kept getting raised to 10,000, 20,000. Some are saying 50,000 to 100,000 people showed up in Los Angeles. Do you see this as a vindication of the work that you and others have been doing to and are hoping to maybe capture this movement? moment, striking it while the iron is hot. I mean, who would have thought that Black Lives Matter would be adopted by the likes of Amazon.com, Mitt Romney, Netflix, and, you know, all of these other mainstream institutions and figures when just a few months ago or a year ago, it was considered too political a statement.
Yeah. The idea that mainstream folks are now saying Black Lives Matter is great. We have to remember that we need people to put their money where their mouth is. So if you're saying Black Lives Matter, but saying that we don't want to defund the police, or you're saying Black Lives Matter and, you know, talking about building trust between Black people and police, you really don't mean what you say, right? Black Lives Matter means that you have to take a bold stand to protect Black life. So defunding the police and defending Black life go hand in hand. We need you to not just say the word Black Lives Matter, but do the work of making Black lives matter.
And sadly, neither Joe Biden nor even Senator Bernie Sanders are willing to come out and say that they agree with this idea, even though both claim that they are on the side of racial justice.
Right. Again, put your money where your mouth is. So, you know, Joe Biden has never really demonstrated himself to be on the side of Black people. He's minimized the role of Black people in all of his campaign work. I hope that people remember that Joe Biden was selected to be Barack Obama's vice president in order to balance out Obama. He's always been seen as a conservative friendly Democrat, right? And so we have to remember that, you know, the answer to Trump is not Joe Biden. The answer to Trump is the people. And so we have to create the change. We have to make it in their political calculation, more advantageous to back the policies and budgets that we need them to back. And so that's really important that we push in that direction. I left something out about the march in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Initially, they were saying it was 20,000 people, but that was one of the most significant moments in the Black Lives Matter movement. We were birthed here in Los Angeles 7 years ago, and we've never seen that level of outpouring. I happened to be on the back of a pickup truck towards the front of the march. And as I stood up and looked out down Hollywood Boulevard, you could not see the end of the march. It went on for 4 or 5 blocks that I could see, but it wasn't even ending at the horizon. It was continuing beyond the horizon. Later, we got some drone footage that an ally had his own drone and flew over, and we're seeing everybody correct their numbers now to say at least 100,000 people were on the streets of Hollywood on Sunday.
Wow. Well, Melina, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out the websites for Black Lives Matter LA and the People's Budget.
Sure. For Black Lives Matter LA, it's blmla.org. And for People's Budget is peoplesbudgetla.com. So that's blmla.org. and peoplesbudgetla.com. And they can always follow us on social media, on Twitter at BLMLA, and on Instagram at BLM Los Angeles.
Melina, thank you for all the work you've done, and really appreciate having you on.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Melina Abdullah, professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA. She's very active with the Los Angeles chapter of Black Lives Matter. We've been discussing a number of issues, including what defund the police actually means. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Newsweek magazine recently published a cover story by Sam Hill entitled OK Millennial, Boomers Are the Greatest Generation in History. In it, he claimed, quote, millennials seem to think their challenges are greater than those any other generation has faced. Not really. Hill wrote, the Great Recession? Nothing compared with the Great Depression. The wealth gap? Today it's actually pretty close to historical averages. Student loans? Student loan debt is $1.6 trillion. Over the next 30 years, boomers will pass down $68 trillion as part of the great wealth transfer. That should cover it for many borrowers. The article's snide tone dismisses the concerns of American youth who are speaking out about the injustices they face in a world that has increasingly abandoned them to falling wages and economic insecurity, gun violence, climate change, and so much more. Now a new book lays out in great detail just how deep the crisis facing American youth is. Its author is Ann Kim, Director of Domestic and Social Policy at the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. She's also a contributing editor to Washington Monthly, and she joins me to discuss her new book entitled Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Welcome to the program, Ann.
Thank you, Sonali, for having me.
So first, how do you respond to this claim that the challenges facing American youth today are no worse than what, say, baby boomers faced?
Wow, that's my first reaction to Sam Hill's article here. So the foundational premise of my book is that there are 4.5 million young people between the ages of 16 and 24 who are not in school, not working. That's 11.5% of all young people. And this is happening in what was, until very recently, the best economy, according to our president, that we have in decades. How it is that so many young people can be disconnected from mainstream economic opportunity, I don't know how the Newsweek cover article can say that millennials have it good, or that young people have it good, because they clearly do not. In fact, we're facing the silent crisis where we have just huge numbers of young people who've fallen off the national conversation, off the radar screen about, you know, our national conversation on inequality, opportunity, and who is getting ahead and who is not. I think that article is really missing the boat.
So the political class in general seems to be missing the boat, given that we are constantly being told that the economy, well, at least pre-coronavirus, was booming, and that that unemployment was at an all-time low. That number that you mentioned of young people who are not in school or don't have jobs, that seems to not be counted when economic indicators such as the official unemployment rate or the number of jobs that are added every month get touted, right?
Well, that's correct, Sonali. The unemployment rate is a misleading number in some ways, in many ways, because it really only counts the number of people who are looking for work. If you are a young person who's essentially given up or is shut out of the labor market, you're not actually counted in that denominator for the unemployment rate. The more accurate number is to look at the employment to population ratio or the workforce participation rate. And when you look at those figures, you will see that young people have been falling out of the economy for quite some time. And that is this disconnection that we are seeing. So this unemployment rate that's been touted really isn't an accurate picture of what is going on with the workforce, especially for youth.
Tell me about what you looked at in basing your book on. If these indicators are left out of our conversation, where did you go to find the real stories, to find that real research that shows the crisis facing America's youth?
Yes, so there are a couple of nonprofits. The one that's been doing some of the most, you know, groundbreaking work on this for a while in terms of data is the Social Science Research Council's Measure of America project. And they have been tracking disconnection in America for quite some time. Now, in the United Kingdom and in the OECD, the question of, you know, young people who are out of school and out of work has been measured for quite a while. In the UK, for instance, it's called NEETS, stands for Not in Employment Education and Training. And since at least 1999, the British government has been keeping track of this figure and releasing quarterly numbers on just how many young people are out of school and out of work. We haven't been doing that. You can't go to the Census Bureau's website and find that out, which is why we have to rely on nonprofits who are finding this data on their own. So the Social Science Research Council's Measure of America project, Brookings Institution has done some work as well. But I think one of the things we really need to do is begin to really measure this problem. That's why our nation hasn't paid attention to this crisis in youth, because we're not even counting young people in our consideration.
So what are some of the ways in which that disconnection is happening? What is the crisis? What do you mean by the crisis of disconnection?
So, you know, one of the, I think, underlying premises behind the Sam Hill's article, you know, he probably does see a lot of millennials and younger people who are doing well, but that is disguising what I think is a divergence in the experiences of young people. There's enormous amount of inequality that's going on. Young people who have, you know, education to go to the places where you can get a good job. The runway to adulthood is taking a lot longer than it used to. And if you have the ability to rely on your parents for a longer period, you might do well. But public policy is failing a very large percentage of young people. Take, for instance, young people who are in the foster care system. The outcomes are horrific there. The enormous numbers of young people who are in the criminal justice system, we are feeling those young people there. And then increasingly, we are seeing regional divergence. Rural young people are falling behind their urban counterparts. That's one of the surprises of disconnection. One in five rural youth is not in school, not in working. It's a much higher percentage than in cities, where there might actually be a little bit more physical proximity to educational opportunities or to jobs. One of the places that I profile in the book is southwestern Pennsylvania. And there, the disconnection rate is close to 75%, 3 out of 4 young people who are not in school, not working.
So there are rural youth, there are indicators about this disconnection in rural America and also in urban America, right?
That's correct. There are what I call opportunity deserts in both places. So on the one hand, you have these areas in rural Pennsylvania I talked about. And then the other, I have a chapter on a neighborhood in Baltimore, Maryland. Now, by all accounts, Baltimore is doing great. You have Under Armour there, you have an Amazon facility that's opened up. But if you go to a neighborhood there called Sandtown, what you'll find are rows upon rows of boarded up townhouses. The high school there is what's still considered a dropout factory, with fewer than 60% of the students graduating at any given time. Bus service is unreliable. The young people I talk to there have to commute for hours, literally, to look for a job, let alone get to one. There, the opportunities are very few. Parents don't have connections to get young people into internships or jobs that pay. That is an urban opportunity desert and is just as limiting as a rural one.
It seems to me that the story about how celebrity and wealthy Americans buying their kids' way into colleges, that was in the news, several months ago, that actually ended up landing some people in prison, that too is part of this story. That more and more those young people who are making it are the exception rather than the rule, and they're making it because their parents are gaming the system because they can, because they are able to, which is also part of the greater story of wealth inequality, right?
Yes. I mean, that's a great example of the divergence I was talking about earlier in the young adult experience. I mean, we see inequality now on a much broader scale. But even within young people, you know, if you are a young person who is growing up in the right place with the right parents, with the right connections, and you're probably going to do fine. And it's because that reliance on connections has become actually a lot more important these days. There's a myth that in America, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, that if you work hard enough, long enough, you will get ahead. And I think that's increasingly untrue, because the structural obstacles that are getting in the way of young people have really become gotten to the point where it's really impossible, no matter how hard you work, no matter how smart you are, no matter how dedicated you become, these structural obstacles stand in the way of your success. And that's what public policy needs to do, is recognize that these structural, geographical, cultural obstacles, educational obstacles exist, and pull them away one by one so everyone can get ahead again if they want.
I wonder if one of the things that stands in the way of this issue becoming more visible is our media's fixation on individual heroic stories, right? We'll hear about a kid who, against all odds, managed to get straight A's and get into college, you know, the five Ivy League schools on full scholarship. And those kinds of stories seem to suggest that if kids just work hard enough, they too can be like this exceptional young person.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the myths that I tackle in the book as well. I think there is this misperception that if a young person is disconnected, it's because of quote unquote poor life choices or quote unquote personal responsibility. And I think there is this stereotype about the disconnected young person being the 20-year-old guy who is just hanging out in their parents' basement. That's not what's going on here. As I said, you know, there are structural obstacles that are standing in the way of young people's success. And I spoke to so many young people in the course of researching this book who really had big aspirations for themselves. You know, they were trying to go to school, they were trying to get jobs, they were really trying to make it, but life was standing in the way.
Does the rise of the gig economy play a big role in this disconnection? Because when you measure job growth or how many jobs have been added to the economy, you don't see the quality of those jobs, the kind of job security that's available. And it seems to, I imagine that it would seem to American youth that for politicians, as long as they're, you know, driving for a rideshare company, that means they have a job, but there's no necessarily job security, paid sick leave, or, you know, it just seems to me that the gig economy is more and more something that corporate America is relying on. And as young workers graduate school, if they even are lucky enough to do so, that this is the kind of job that's available to them now.
I think that's right. I mean, there's been a lot of emphasis, as you point out, on the growth in jobs. And sure, the number of jobs might be great, but the quality of those jobs, as you point out, is subpar. You know, there have been surveys of young workers, and large majorities of young workers believe that they are in jobs that are, you know, that they're underemployed, you know, that they're not using the education that they do have. It's harder for young people to break into industry these days, to get that foothold into the labor market. Employers have cut down on the amount of training that they do. There are fewer apprenticeship programs, work experience programs than there should be. It's a lot easier for an employer to find somebody, an older worker who may have some experience, rather than to take a chance on investing in a younger person. And that's something else that needs to change with the private sector as well. We need to move away from the temporary workers, gig workers, throwaway workers, and really begin to invest again in workers and in young workers in particular.
What is the racial disparity within American youth? I imagine that just as in so many other social indicators, people of color tend to fare worse than their white peers.
That's absolutely right. Now, Measure America finds that if you are a person of color, you are about twice as likely to be a disconnected young person than someone who is not. Interestingly, the gender balance is about equal. Among women, if you're young women, if you are disconnected, it's likely because you're a young mom. If you are a young man who is not in work and not in school, it is likely because that you have been just as involved in some way. And of course, you know, the racial disparities in the criminal justice system have been documented, and those are really tragic consequences we see there as well.
Right, and this is not a new issue. We've been having this conversation thanks largely to the work of grassroots activists who've been working to reform the criminal justice system, that it starts in school, that youth of color, that kids of color start being disciplined at disproportionate rates in schools. We hear stories of police arresting even little kids under the age of 10 who are Black for acting out. And all of that, of course, sets a kid up very early in life to be repeatedly criminalized, right?
No, that's right. And a young person who is not in school is not going to be set up for success. You know, as you point out, young people of color are disproportionately singled out, disproportionately expelled, disproportionately suspended, and then disproportionately in detention. You know, incarceration is probably one of the most catastrophic outcomes that can happen for a young person. Not only are these young people deprived of any opportunities to further their education or to get any valuable job skills, I saw there a number I cite in my book is that fewer than 10% of any detention facilities have any sort of educational or training opportunities available to those who are incarcerated. Young people are also more likely to be sexually assaulted while they are in detention. And most tragically, 70 to 80% of them are likely to reoffend within 2 to 3 years. There's no clearer way, shorter way to short-circuiting someone's chances for success than to have them involved in the criminal justice system and incarcerated. And it's absolute sabotage of a young person's odds of success.
What are the systemic issues that need to be addressed? I imagine that some of the broad policy prescriptions that are promoted by progressive folks and organizations such as Medicare for All, raising the federal minimum wage, et cetera, would go a long way toward addressing this crisis. It's no surprise that, say, a presidential candidate like Bernie Sanders is hugely popular among American youth.
Mm-hmm. You know, yes, but the caveat there is that, you know, the minimum wage, things like that, are helpful for those who are already connected to the workforce in some way. When we're talking about those who have no connection, there are even deeper structural challenges that need to be addressed, and that is reforming the child welfare system. I alluded to this earlier, but, you know, the young people who age out of the foster care system, there are about 20,000 of them. A third of them are going to end up homeless. A third of them are going to end up incarcerated. Fewer than half will have a job by the age of 26. The child welfare system, a system that is supposed to be protecting the welfare of these kids, is doing the exact opposite of that. So fixing that system is paramount. Fixing the criminal justice system is paramount. Diverting more young people, especially nonviolent young people, young offenders, away from incarceration. Third, the educational system, so that young people who are graduating from high school actually have skills that they can use in the workforce. And then four, fixing this problem of geographic inequality, where young people who are marooned in places where the factories have gone away or where the jobs are gone can still find some way of success where they live. I think what's happening with young people is a symptom of these broader trends in inequality that are kind of ripping the country apart, and they're a harbinger of worse things to come.
Well, Anne, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Anne Kim. She's director of domestic and social policy at the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and a contributing editor to Washington Monthly. We've been discussing her new book, Abandoned: America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kits Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. and follow us on twitter.com/RUwithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.